Welcome back, everybody, after the break. My name's Auriel Miller. I'm the director of the IWA. From experience, I know that this room can get a little bit chilly sometimes, so do please let one of the IWA team know if you're feeling a bit cold or a bit too hot, so that you're comfortable and get the most out of the sessions. We're running only slightly behind time, and I'm sure we'll make it up. I'm going to hand over now to Carol Green again to chair this next session, which is going to be a fascinating panel, Creating Our Pipeline. Carol.
Welcome back. Hopefully you're recharged and refreshed, and once again you will have opportunities to question our panel. I'd like to welcome them, and if you'd just like to introduce yourselves. So I'm sure you're very familiar with everybody up on the top table here, but just if we start with you, Carol, that would be great.
Caroline Davis, Design Commissioner for Wales, Chief Executive.
Rodri Williams, Ofcom's Director for Wales.
Dan Saville, I'm an Infrastructure Director for ARUP.
Thank you. And Dan, if we start with you, just give us a little idea of the sorts of areas you're working in, how that relates in terms of infrastructure, and this question of how do we create our pipeline?
Yeah, thanks, Carol. So, so we're based, based down in Cardiff Bay. I've been there for about 50 years, and we're a kind of global consultancy getting in all aspects of the built environment. So we've touched on many of these projects, the major projects that we've been talking about this morning, Swansea Bay, the electrification of the railway, M4 Relief Road, and the like. I've spent the last 3 years based over in Toronto, and I guess if I talk about that aspect and
external what
I observe from there and how it might be applied to Wales, I think there's four quick points. The first one is kind of demonstrable value for money. So there's procurement processes set up that are delivering the outcomes that they want, not just the outputs, and not just the railway, not just the road. It's about service levels. It's about community benefits and improvements. So demonstrable value for money. The second one is expertise. So they've got pooled expertise. They've got agencies that are set up so that they're not going to, if they want to build a $1 billion light rail system, they're not going to someone who's doing it for the first time. They're going to somebody that's done it 30 times. And that expertise has proved really valuable in creating that pipeline. The third one is a kind of competitive environment that the industry knows that the pipeline is there and that it will be delivered. And this is good for driving innovation, driving efficiency, and it's also pretty essential, picking up on this morning's session, on attracting and retaining the talent. And I know from running a business in Wales that's why people come to work for ARUP. They want to work on exciting projects. So how do we give them that foresight of what that looks like? And the fourth one, perhaps the most important one, is politicians with the grit and gravitas to get things done, to act as champions for these projects, be solution focused and problem solving, and not allowing the obstacles that get in the way of these projects to slow things down too dramatically, whilst acknowledging that we need to look at sustainability and all the other issues and the community impacts and all of that that goes into delivering a major project. So that's what I saw and observed in Ontario particularly, and there's lots going on there, and it's a very exciting place to be, as is Wales.
You have that inside and outside view, so I'm very keen to hear from you. How do we shape up here in Wales? Where are we in that journey?
Well, if I look at the kind of the positives, I mean, it's great that we have, as of last week, whenever it was, or 2 weeks ago, we have a plan. So this plan says we will build a metro, we will build significant improvements around the M4. I think what sits behind that is the political will and the political drive, and it is funded. There are line items for some of these major interventions. If I think about some of the weaknesses in that, we are at the beck and call of the political life cycle. With these projects, I've been involved personally with the M4 for nearly 30 years. So these projects take a long time to come to fruition. When we had a coalition government, in the first few months it was the priority project. 6 months on, it was unaffordable. So these projects take so long to come to fruition, and I think that's one of the weaknesses that we have in Wales, is linking these major projects to the political life cycle. So some way of depoliticising the delivery of the projects, I think, is would be a good thing. And I think we do have a problem with attracting and retaining the best talent. And I think that is a problem over the next 1, 2, 3 years as the major interventions in England particularly start to take shape. So you've got Hinkley, you've got High Speed 2, you've got Crossrail. For the bright young things coming through, where do you want to work? And we've got to create a kind of compelling argument that, that Wales is open for business and Wales is a great place to have a long and happy career.
Because we're not the only ones in the market.
We're certainly not the only ones in the market. And I would also put that point onto the kind of contracting community as well. Contractors are going to have some difficult choices for these major projects. What are they going to bid for? Are they going to bid for the A303 Stonehenge bypass? Are they going to bid for the A465 Section 5 and 6? Which one is creates that right balance of risk? Which one gives them the good chance of winning and gives them the reward?
And from your background, what are they looking for there? The drive to deliver? You know, who's got the capability and the capacity to deliver the vision?
Well, I think they're looking for a pipeline. I mean, these major projects take a huge amount of investment from the contracting community, especially if it, the PFI route, and there's several, this mutual investment model that may come to us, and in fact the South Wales Metro that is currently underway. It's a huge investment. So I think certainty is important, and when these projects get pushed back, you know, South Wales Metro has been pushed back and pushed back in terms of the whole procurement, we've got to be really careful that when we say we're going to do something, we actually follow through and do it to the timeline that's set out. I think that's pretty crucial.
View from the development community there, if we move this way, Rodri, looking at infrastructure in its widest sense, digital infrastructure, is it more important now almost than the physical infrastructure? Are we getting to that stage?
Well, certainly, I think if we're looking to send the message that Wales is open for, and the whole of Wales is open for business, not just Indeed. Specific bits of it, then certainly I think the digital infrastructure is absolutely essential. Gone are the days when it was a sort of nice to have. It is now an essential. I think that means not only fast, reliable, affordable broadband, it also means ubiquitous or near to ubiquitous mobile coverage, and that's data coverage as well as voice coverage, because that is what's needed for business uses, and I'm including in business uses there the increasing use that agriculture makes of digital infrastructure, and I think on the whole, I think we've been slow to realise that, so we are behind the game in certain senses, and I also think that we have more to do than other parts of the UK, and people haven't realised that. So to give you two concrete examples of that, if we look at superfast broadband, the market delivered 48% of premises in Wales, and then said, there we are, we've done our bit, we're stopping. So that left 52% of the country, and that's a mixture of homes and businesses needing to be connected, and it is the public purse that has to inject something into that process to make it happen, and the government, I think, has done a pretty good job of doing that. But the scale of the task, much bigger than any other part of the UK. And that becomes apparent as well in the mobile sphere, where the topography, the distribution of our population in Wales makes it more difficult, more costly, therefore less attractive. And like broadband, up until now at least, the mobile industry is not one that has what's called a universal service obligation. So the four major mobile network operators do what they want to do. They're not obliged to go any further. They're not obliged to provide services where they don't want to, where they don't think they can make a return on it. But to give an idea again of the scale of the task here, talk a bit about television infrastructure, which to all intents and purposes people regard as being universal. It's not quite, but it's not far off. In England, it takes 12 television transmitters to reach an audience of a million. In Northern Ireland, it takes 25. In Scotland, it takes 45. In Wales, it takes 67. So the scale of the task, and of course, although you know, I'm talking at one level about digital infrastructure, delivering it is a very physical process.
Got both.
You either need to dig up the roads and the fields to provide fibre, because that really is the way that this is going to be delivered at the end of the day, not through copper cables hanging on poles, or to get mobile infrastructure, you need masts. And you need a lot of them, and they need to be bigger. And I'll finish on just one point, picking up again from what Dan said about politicians with grit. I mean, I hear quite often from politicians and from a wide range of other people in Wales that there should be as close to ubiquitous mobile coverage as you can get. But then people say, but maybe we don't want to put masts on top of hills in areas that are in the national parks. Well, I'm afraid it's a binary choice. If you want the coverage, you have to have the masts. If you want to be in an area where the emergency service won't have access to their network in the future, well, by all means, oppose the construction of masts. But I just think we have to have it, and we have to move a bit faster to ensure that when we are trying to develop indigenous businesses or attracting new businesses to Wales, they have the communications infrastructure that is needed.
And in many ways, it's those marginalised areas, economically marginalised, that need it the most, that are most difficult to reach, that yes. have the most to gain from it.
Absolutely. I think some of the benefits for consumers and for the public purse in Wales will be utilised by being able to deploy remote medicine, for instance, in rural areas, where it means that you're cutting down on journeys made to hospitals that are increasingly becoming further and further away, perhaps with the specialities you need. The technology is there to do away with a lot of that, but you have to have the ability to connect with it, to use the technology. And I think that, it can sometimes be surprising. So, for instance, one of the large infrastructure projects, it's already been mentioned a few times, Ulva B in Anglesey, we've had probably more complaints relating to the lack of digital infrastructure in Anglesey than almost anywhere else in Wales, and it's directly linked to people coming to Anglesey for that project and finding that the infrastructure is lacking, and that has certainly created a problem for those working on the project and trying to take that forward. So although it's primarily in those areas that are at the fringes, it can sometimes have an equally dramatic effect in somewhere where you would think that provision is better.
So impacting, slowing down. Moving on, Carol Ann, we've got two Carol Anns on this panel. I don't think I've done that before, but yes, just from a Design Commission Wales perspective.
Is that another IWA first?
Quite possibly.
Good morning, yeah. One of the first things I'd like to say is that it's really important to talk this up. People are listening, and they don't want to hear a nation talking about how hard it is, and I just wanted to emphasise Dan's point. We have the prospect of the National Development Framework coming, which is a huge spatial opportunity to set down what we want for this nation. We have a We Will plan with the Metro. Sadly, we don't yet have a tidal lagoon, and yes, that is appalling, and we don't quite know why that's being held up. But we have a new Planning Act, and we have a Future Generations Act, which is world first. And it is legislation, so politics might be seen quite differently when the law can be used actually to stimulate some of this rather than to block it. So I think that's a huge opportunity. I think the other thing about that, I asked a 10-year-old this morning what I should say, and he said, give everyone a train instead of roads. And arguably, this room should be full of 10-year-olds. It's their world that we'll be making. And Russell made the point this morning as well about what does Wales have? So the world we want to leave, or to be as good as the one we have inherited. And if Wales has a USP, it is beauty. So our infrastructure should be efficient and it should be beautiful. So within the opportunities we have, I think it would be really useful for us to begin to think differently about the hardware that we need. To think about, you know, our health service is an infrastructure. Food production, consumption and distribution is an infrastructure, just as much as energy generation and distribution is. And these are all opportunities because they're the hardware we need to keep moving, keep breathing clean air and keep having access to water. And if we don't get those things right, the trains really won't matter. There is still a climate urgency around this. In the Netherlands recently, I've been really interested in an approach that they're taking. I was there last week at a project we're working on in Wales for the Welsh Government. And they're beginning to manage risk entirely differently. So if you think this is a country the size of Wales, and yes, okay, it's flat, but it is below sea level. But it is keeping 17 million people moving in one of the most productive nations. It has opened 5 runways at Amsterdam Schiphol during the time of the Heathrow 3rd 1A inquiry. And what it is beginning to do, the local councils and The Hague are beginning to look at risk in a different way. And they're beginning to assess and communicate risk to the politicians to prepare them for the acceptance of failure. And unless we can accept failure, you will never reach innovation. And those people that solve our problems, our designers, our civil engineers, our talent and our experts, however unpopular they may be with certain sectors of society, expertise matters and it will add value. Last thing on this bit I will say is that young people need to see what they can be. And one of the really good examples, and there are many, if you want children to imagine and to think like Brunel or Telford and to be able to work in industries that can leave us that kind of legacy, they need to see it. So when we were with our own infrastructure panel, which is part of our design panel, working on the Newtown bypass, in a great engagement process with them, they were in the schools and they were talking to children about the biggest civil engineering project, probably since the Severn Bridge. I remember the first Severn Crossing when I was a child. It's really exciting stuff. This is brilliant. And kids need to see it. Young women in particular need to see it because the industry needs women. So I would say, cheer up, we've got some great opportunities. Let's have a bit of, you know, professional collaboration and talk up the skills that we have so that talking skills up is how you attract new skills. People want to work for you if you sound, you know, and you demonstrate an enthusiasm for wanting to get this stuff done. That's enough from me for a minute. Sorry.
Thank you to our panel for those introductions. I think that's a good place to sort of throw it open to the floor. Plenty there. I'm just making green, you know, looking at green infrastructure, widening it out, future generations, take risks, and also talk it up. Have we been too negative this morning? We've looked more possibly at the challenges rather than the opportunity. So this is your opportunity for more questions to our panel. So who'd like to start us off? Do we have a question? Calvin, go for it.
Away. And the I was saying to various people that we don't, for example, have any idea of what a socially coherent, sustainable, productive rural community looks like in 2050. I have no idea what sort of infrastructures, social as well as physical and digital, would enable a community to flourish in a climate change world in 30 or 40 years' time in Wales. And that thinking, listening to this morning, has made me think that we maybe need to consider the difference between infrastructure for inter-community or inter-place purposes and infrastructure for intra-community. Yeah. Come back to this kind of, it's not quite green infrastructure. I sometimes think one of the biggest infrastructure developments, if you can call it that, for my community in the valleys would be one house with a stainless steel kitchen that could create meals, not on wheels, but meals on feet for local elderly people in that community. It's a very small thing, but it would relocalise, you know, economic activity. It would enable people to talk to each other more, and lots of co-benefits. And, you know, it comes back to these points about how we have to develop a continuum of infrastructure investments, which go from the really big stuff, which obviously needs doing in various ways, down to stuff which actually enables communities to be more coherent and more functional. And it probably won't be the National Infrastructure Commission's job, but if nobody does it, what we'll end up with is well connected crap communities, and I want to avoid that really.
So inter and intra connectivity, and also things that make a place, infrastructure that makes a place. Dan, would you like to talk?
Yeah, I mean, I would hope that the Infrastructure Commission for Wales does look at exactly those things. I mean, I think Wales has many of the same problems as other parts of the UK and other parts of the world in terms of ageing population, you know, decrepit infrastructure that hasn't been replaced for many years. All of those issues are kind of pandemic, but Wales has its own set of issues in terms of rural isolation, the kind of post-industrial kind of legacy, all those issues which I would have thought should be at the heart of what the Infrastructure Commission does look at and recognises that the communities themselves need to be coherent, but also need to be viable in terms of employment, youth unemployment particularly, and connecting to the cities. I think on the other hand, you know, Wales has a particular rural issue, but we've also got a problem that our cities aren't big enough. And so things like the South East Wales Metro will create that kind of agglomeration benefits and creating a population of a million people that can have easy access to employment and then kind of spend their money back in the communities, perhaps.
Role of digital in that picture, Roderick?
Well, I think it's taken as a you know, for granted in rural areas where you not only have the provision of the kind of broadband service I was talking about earlier, but you actually have competition in it, and you can choose between one provider and another, and you have a variety of services, you know, depending on whether it's cost you're after or whether it's speed or whether it's reliability. Whereas in the vast part of geographic Wales, you know, the country is dependent upon one supplier to provide the infrastructure, and for perfectly good reasons. If I was a shareholder of BT, yes, I would certainly want to sweat copper cable until the last possible coin has been extracted from it. But if you're looking at it from a point of view of societal benefit, then you need to replace that with fibre, and you need to enable people to live and to work in remote and rural communities as if they were in cities. And if you're, I mean, just to take the example of somebody I visited in South Ceredigion recently, who's a graphic designer, almost all the work done is done outside of Wales and most of it outside of the UK. Clearly, that can only happen in South Ceredigion if he has the digital infrastructure available. So I think, I don't think it's possible necessarily always to attain parity. It's a bit like roads, you know, you don't expect everybody to have access to a three-lane motorway. But there has to be a sort of
a baseline
that you can expect, and that needs to be high enough to enable that kind of economic. I mentioned the benefits, you know, to health earlier. There are all kinds of schools. You know, it's an essential component, and trying to get that fairer distribution of the of what's available between urban and rural areas, I think, is key.
Especially when we see the depopulation, people moving out of rural communities, particularly, you know, Anglesey has a real problem with the migration out.
Yes.
Because people can't make a living there if the infrastructure isn't there in various ways.
Yeah. And
to build the community, to build the place.
And in terms of enabling mobility as well, people nowadays, you know, when they're buying houses, are looking at what is available in terms of digital infrastructure as much as looking at the physical aspects of what they're buying. And I think that's only going to become more apparent as we move forward.
Caroline?
I think, again, the point about city scale is really important. There is a kind of psychological position in Wales that we are rural here and urban there. And the fact is that urbanisation is a global phenomenon. We are urbanising, and it's a reality. And in 2012, we did a major conference in Swansea called City Futures in partnership with the City Council to look at what that meant for health services, for transport, for connections, and for whatever it means. And the really important thing, if you want to take a place-based approach, and we've been banging on about places for many years, you've got to start with people. You don't start with procurement, and you don't start with compliance and the law. You start with people on their doorsteps, in their places. And in some of the... You can see there's perfectly reasonable decisions to spend money in certain areas of our hinterland, shall we say, that... despite all the effort, really good effort that's gone in, you still have towns right in the middle that are completely isolated where people can't, shift workers, can't get a bus to work for 6 o'clock in the morning. And that's outrageous. So we're missing something. And in all the projects that we've dealt with and the long conversations we're still having on places like Wilver, National Grid, and all those things that will hit places like Anglesey, and I think you're right, 25,000 people leave the island every day. There's a lot about project objectives and the role of inspectors and standing orders, and nobody talks about betterment for people. It's an old-fashioned word, betterment, but it's what public money should be about, and it's what public value should be about. What is the return on taxpayers' money for the people? And I know it's really old-fashioned, but it's extremely important. That's what this stuff is for. It's also for the industry. You know, we do need work, we do need jobs, we do need skills, but we also need people to live in a better place as a result of that investment.
So facilitator, really, facilitating.
Talk to people, yeah.
Oriel.
Is this one on? Great. I just wanted to draw everybody's attention to, and I've just tweeted the link actually, something called usp.scot, Understanding Scottish Places.
Yeah.
The Design Commission for Wales kindly hosted a stakeholder session back in June looking at making those data sets available, not just in Scotland, but also doing a similar thing for Wales, looking at the dependency, interdependency between locations. So what town is like another town, where is better to live from which point of view. And I wondered if, just from a show of hands in the room, who is aware of that piece of work in Scotland, Understanding Scottish Places? Carnegie Trust did it, together with the Centre for Local Economic Strategies. But I really suggest you go and have a look at it, because it's under discussion at the moment for doing something similar in Wales. And I think it would get at a lot of these issues in terms of both attracting in potential investors, seeing what sort of labour forces are available, what the skills are like, what the education is like, and so forth, but also encouraging, picking up on your point, Dan, in making Wales a really attractive place for people to both live and build a career. So if you haven't seen it, go and have a look.
Top tip, yes?
Just a quick follow-up to that. It was really interesting the way that came about, because it came about on the back of the Design Commission Shape My Town tool, which is specifically for places, but it doesn't allow us to work for people, it allows people to work for themselves. And what we wanted to do is to connect Shape My Town to Understanding Scottish Places. And it's another important thing, really, is we have to remember that we don't have all the answers and other people might have some of the answers. So collaborating, whether it's within or out with Wales, is really important. And none of us have got all the best ideas. So getting Scottish Places in the room with us was really value-adding for us. And you can find it all on the website. So a bit more of that as well, please. That'd be great.
So collaboration.
Carol, can I just build on that point briefly? Is that okay?
Yeah,
one observation from me is that government is far more comfortable specifying the how rather than the what. It's more comfortable specifying outputs, the road, the railway, the spacing of the signal posts, all the rest of it, than actually the outcomes that are derived from that intervention. And I think we've got to get a lot smarter at specifying those outcomes and then driving that through the procurement process so that the community that are tendering are charged with delivering the outcomes and not the outputs.
So really that comes back to our original vision.
Yeah.
That needs to be incorporated into the big picture vision.
Yeah, and infrastructure being an enabler, not the thing itself.
An end in itself.
Yeah.
Okay, plenty to chew on and think about there. Yes?
I'm an individual, not associated with an organisation. I'd like to make a comment rather than a question, particularly aimed at Rodri Williams, please.
Yep.
First of all, a comment about the fact you mentioned 48% broadband and then it stopped from the industry. I would suggest that a contributing factor to that is actually the promise of public government money. Once they think they can get some money out of government, they will sort of hold off and rather than find it themselves and continue. That's a suggestion. You may have a view on that. More seriously, you mentioned television transmitters and mobile phones and, first of all, broadband. And you clearly refer to these heavily relying on cable, perhaps to supply transmitters on mountaintops, fibre optic cable for broadband by implication. But don't forget, because fibre optic cable also supplies the local transmitters for mobile phones. So fibre optic is involved in both of those cases. Really we're talking about fibre optic installations come to a bit of a halt, and you're still talking as though that's going to be the way things are going to have to go in the next few years' time. And I would seriously question that. I honestly think that in 4 or 5 years from now, it won't matter whether you could be in the Gobi Desert, quite literally, never mind rural Wales. Elon Musk and other reusable rocket pioneers are already, part of their business plans, rely on the idea of microsatellites, swarms of microsatellites. They could probably be the size of baked bean tins or even smaller. They will be continuously renewable, so there's a market for continuously launching them up. As some come down, more go up. And the idea is that there's always going to be in sight somewhere in the sky near where you are. The principle will be, in a sense, similar to mobile phones, where you have cells that switch from one to the other. It's all done automatically. So I don't know whether you'd like to comment on that, but I think investment in fibre optics for broadband in the likes of rural Wales and other similar places is likely to be probably a bit of a waste from now on, because by the time it gets in, the microsatellite revolution will have be real.
So some future gazing there, but maybe not so far ahead. What's your view?
I think it's an exciting prospect. Clearly, there is some deployment of satellite broadband in Wales already. Typically, those who use it don't like it. They don't like its behavioural characteristics. It doesn't work as well. There is a latency. Now, admittedly, I tend to take the view that only affects a small number of people, those wanting to play online games or trade on the world stock exchanges in real time, where it is clearly a crippling problem. But for most things, it can work. My only question is, can it happen in time? Typically, people who currently, and we're down to about the last 4 or 5% of premises in Wales who don't have access to superfast broadband, they've been hanging on the promise of getting a better service for a long time. Are they willing to wait, or does something have to be done in the interim? I think, there is a risk that you build something with one technology and it gets superseded by another one that can do it. It deals with the problem of our topography beautifully well, doesn't it? It does away with the hills. And there are other ways, using microwave links, as television is utilised over many years, to connect transmitters in rural places. I'm just of the opinion at this point in time that it's not quite close in. I wish it, that the sooner the better it's available and there is more choice.
Make this point.
You're
referring to delays in transmission. You're talking about geostationary satellites, which are 24,000 miles away or whatever. These satellites I'm talking about are going to be about 100 miles away, quite literally. It's going to be swarms of them, so they'll always be above your head somewhere. We're not talking about one or a few, we're talking about many. When I say the size of baked bean tins or smaller, I mean that literally. So it's a different... The delay times won't be... They may even be less, frankly, than the delay times you get with fibre optic cable, because even though they're insignificant, relatively speaking, to geostationary satellites, they're still
It's
delayed.
A good point, but I do want to move on.
Thank you.
Rodri's point that where we are now, we do need to get the... that physical infrastructure in, physical digital infrastructure in, before we get there. But obviously, we've had a little look at what might be coming down the line, and of course, that's always good to have an eye on the future. So, Robert?
It's a short question. What are the
Always
panel's
welcome.
Thoughts on, you know, we're talking about infrastructure. What are the panel's thoughts on funding or finance?
Carol, would you like to start with that?
There are these days all sorts of financing mechanisms and magic, and you can call them whatever you like. Fundamentally, it's still the investment of public funds for public value, and I think the way we calculate that value needs to change. And also perhaps the way we think about investing public money, where we think about short-term capital cost all of the time and not about long-term public value. So we still need to be getting that locked into the demonstration of need for the project, the clarity of vision for the project, and the clear objectives which are user-focused for every single project that we do, and to assess value on that basis and the return that we are getting. Spending money lowest cost, short-term, fastest, quickest, cheapest, as we found actually, to huge cost and very recently huge human cost possibly, is maybe not the way you should be investing public funds, arguably.
So back to people looking to the long term, getting away from that short termism, and also looking at the whole, that calculating the whole value, not just pounds and pence.
The whole value, and for, you know, there's a room full of people here who've been doing whole life costing and all that stuff for years, but somehow we still haven't quite cracked it, and it's partly about the political palatability. And the understanding that what is the purpose of public money if it's not for public good? And everybody wins. You know, you can look at, you know, I hope everybody's excited about what's happened in Central Square, but if you get you get a developer that gets a better scheme, that makes a better city, you know, and that's enabled by all sorts of public mechanisms and partnerships, you get better places, you get a better outcome, you get betterment. That's the return you should be looking for. Is it pounds, shillings and pence, or is it something as well as pounds, shillings and pence, arguably?
So added value, but maybe not even that it should be added value, it should be intrinsic from the start, but it should be embedded from the get-go. Did I say that?
Can I have a go at partly answering that?
Yes, yes. One thing I'm quite interested in, Dan, is obviously you've been out there, seen those good examples in Ontario. Mm. Just give us a little flavour of those. Who's getting it right? Well, where can we go? Well, you know, what does good look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to say in response to your comment is there's no such thing as a free lunch. And as Carol Ann said, if you want to build public infrastructure, at some point the public's going to have to pay for it. I guess the question is the public sector the best place to deliver that infrastructure over its entire life cycle? Going out to Canada, I was a huge PPP, PFI skeptic, having been partly involved in some projects here. But they love it over there. And it tangibly influences the whole life cost assessment and the way things are procured. Just a brief anecdote, if I may. The first year I spent tendering for a $5 billion rail project, we lost that project because the winning contractor, and it was only a two-horse race, the winning team, who were going to run this thing for 25 years, had the bright idea of putting building a power station that would power this light rail project, and that the way that the concession was set up in terms of the cost of energy over the life cycle was better value for the public purse. So, you know, real innovation through what actually is quite a simple concept. I mean, unfortunately, they had the idea and not our team. But at the end of the day, you know, is the private sector the best place to deliver the whole life of the asset? And in England, they're thinking of PFI for several projects, Stonehenge, Lower Thames Crossing, notwithstanding Mr. Corbyn's recent pronouncements on the subject. And we're thinking of the same thing here in Wales with the mutual investment model. So I think a toolkit of various procurement approaches, various funding mechanisms, and perhaps for the more complex projects, we should think a bit more innovatively than design and build.
So beyond design and build, more about innovation. Who's best placed to do that? Private sector. Sorry, just because you've asked one, I'll come back to you, Leslie. Oh, you're there. Go on, go for it.
If Wales really is trying to do something different in terms of sustainable development, then I think the fact that we're taking time to do it is positive. It's not really just get ahead, because many of these major infrastructure projects will cost a very, very great deal of money, and they'll last a very, very long time. And that all goes back to the experts. I mean, I was still taught about Adam Smith, that you can't have a positive economy if you don't have a sea border to get your goods out. I mean, Switzerland, as it is today, didn't exist in Adam Smith's time, but in economics lectures, we're still being taught that. So there is no expert in post-industrial development. We're going to have to make it up as we go along. I'm going to have to try and get it right. And what happened in America with Trump, because nobody was addressing those people, it hasn't been addressed. There are no experts. A lot of the economic models don't and won't work for rural areas, for post-industrial areas. We'll have to create our expertise as we go along.
Caroline, would you like to respond to that, it's failed and broken, I think, possibly. Is that what you're saying? There are no experts. We've got to start where we are, use what we've got, do what we can.
It's really interesting when you run the Design Commission for Wales and you're across all disciplines and you're a critical friend and nobody really loves you and nobody really hates you. but that's your job. And people will often say, well, I don't know anything about architecture, but... Mm. You live in it every day. You live in urban design any day. You use transport every day. You are the experts. We are experts. And but there are really clever people like Dan and Chris Joffe, who's sitting over there, and others who are kind of a little bit more expert. And we need to understand our contribution as people who use these places. This is the only world that it interests me that we talk about things without thinking about how people use things. You know, we know how people use phones, use cars, use health services, whatever, but we don't talk about how people catch a train or a bus or want to walk somewhere or cycle somewhere. So recognise what people and members of the public can bring to the debate, I think, but also, as I said earlier, use these people. They trained for years to get this stuff and they're really good at it. So a mix, I think, to crack that particular nut.
So user experience to come to the fore.
Indeed, yeah, and some of the bigger the projects, I'm thinking about some of the stuff in England that they've done, but also in Stockholm, they've kept it really simple, and they've said it has to be twice as good as it was before, and you have to think about human scale. What is this like for people standing on a platform in the wind, horizontal rain, in the middle of Montgomeryshire, or wherever you are? What's it like for that person? What is it like for Mrs. Jones from Blaen y Gwent to be able to get to the shops or whatever it is? And we forget. So please, I would say focus on the user.
User experience. And not that we've got time to debate it now, but very interesting as populations change as well and sure. Age. Mm. User experience in terms of the physical environment, dementia friendly, there's just those sorts of ideas coming to the fore. How does a city or a place work for a wide range of needs?
For a mix, yes. And the housing innovation project that's going on at the moment, everybody's thinking about the unit when a lot of the cost for people, for householders, is transport. What does it cost you to get out there? And particularly, sorry to bang on about this, but for women, you're doing the school run, you're doing the clinical run, if the kids need healthcare or whatever, you're the person who's probably not at home with a car. And that's still a reality, unfortunately. So the household cost, so maybe the innovation around housing is actually transport and connections. So I think we need to just think about this differently. The ageing population is also an asset. Mm-hmm. Yes, we do have a difficulty, but we have huge experience and we have increasingly fit, active people who are living longer, as well as those who are being a bit talked down because they are a drain on the health service. So I think look at it as a mix, and I strongly recommend talking to a 10-year-old at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Right. We had a question at the back.
Chris Jovey from Arup. I was very interested to hear what Carol-Anne had to say about the changing attitude of politicians in the Netherlands to embracing a little bit more risk to deliver better outcomes. And I'd be interested in the views of the panel about what we can do to help Welsh politicians take a broader view of risk so that we can deliver better outcomes for Wales.
Well, it's an Arup question, so I won't go to Dan first. Rodri, would you like to pick that one up? Well, we need to take risks and learn to fail.
Absolutely. I was just thinking of that earlier, actually, that being as risk-averse as we are only creates problems. And I speak since, you know, having been close to the process in different contexts since the advent of devolution, that unwillingness to fail, that not being prepared to try something and risk that it fails, is a huge problem for us. And I think that I think there's a lot that we can do for ourselves and can do it ourselves. But I think the idea of looking at what works well in other places and learning the lessons could be particularly useful there. I think Dan mentioned earlier about the pace of getting things done. And I think a lot of that is around being so risk averse and really, you know, doing too much due diligence. On things, some of which does not contribute the slightest yacht to the outcome for the end user. It is process for process sake. It is process because I think process is easier. And I work for an organization that I think is sometimes guilty of doing a lot of that itself, where it is much easier to put in place a process to make sure that you've covered off all the risks and taken enough time and consulted with everybody under the sun. But that doesn't necessarily give you any better outcome. You might be better off just taking a risk on something and seeing if it works or not. And being willing to do it at small scale, and I think in a country in Wales, that's important, that you're willing to start small, and not necessarily, if something does work in one part of Wales, not necessarily wanting to replicate it everywhere, because the fact that it works in Anglesey doesn't mean that it's going to work in Blaenau Gwent.
So not one size fits all, inertia, too much process, get bogged down, inertia kicks in. So, and that willingness to fail, key to getting things done. So more doing rather than deliberating. Is that the...
Can I just qualify the comment as well, because I was gossiping with Chris about this earlier, but the reason this has come about is that the Rotterdam City Council were very clear and said that, you know, there's no money anymore, there never will be any money again. So we have to do things differently. And I've heard this phrase this morning, do things differently. I have to say that they kind of focus on the do things rather than the differently, because they have to. You know, when you live under sea level, that is your issue, you know. But their approach is that they now have to work with partners, their resources are slashed, you know, so if you want to create the conditions for that, we have them. It's the kind of resilience and ingenuity of talent in tight circumstances. That's when creativity really works, is in constraint, not in freedom. And one of the things they've acknowledged is those projects that we hold up as great, they are rule breakers. Now, I'm not suggesting that they don't meet regulations, but if you look at things like Milau Viaduct and all those things, they meet every regulation while they break every rule, and that's why they're game changers. So you have to be able to communicate why that matters. Otherwise, you're going to just do things you always have done, and nothing's going to change.
Keep getting the same, do the same, get the same, same result. So really, they're an old phrase, isn't it? Necessity, mother of invention. So if we want to be an innovative, it's when we're constrained, it's when there's no money in the pot, that's when we're creative and when we collaborate. Ben.
Thanks very much indeed. Firstly, thank you very much for the contribution so far. Very, very insightful. So Ben Cartam, FSB Wales. I was very struck, Caroline, by your perspective of the Netherlands. I too was in the Netherlands last week looking at their skills system and the notion of the Polder model, which shared ownership and recognition of shared ownership and the ownership of the solutions was very, very stark. And it struck me that those similarities exist here. We are at a point in economic development in Wales where the need for quite dramatically reconstructed partnerships between government and business is arguably needed. We recognize the situation, but arguably whereas we're closely networked, we're never so far away as possibly we are now. So I guess it's more of a point in support of your point. The need for us to bring in the private sector and other partners in designing the solutions for our infrastructure issues. And I guess just to reflect on another point about rural connectivity, it is very good to talk about the technology that's coming down the line, but we should not be in any doubt about the urgency of need for digital connectivity in rural Wales. This is one of the things that my members throughout Wales come up with again and again. And in the absence of significant investment in heavy physical infrastructure, such as roads and rail, that is one of the things that we can do to make sure that there is no area of Wales that is exempt from the ambition of economic development.
Absolutely. So keep going, Clotry. I think that's what the message there. But I do just want to put that to Dan, because you were speaking there, Ben, about bringing in the private sector to look at our infrastructure challenges. What do we need? You know, what role? How big a role? We've got this whole question around process.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, picking up on the risk question as well is how the public sector and how the private sector can work together. If the projects are there, I think the private sector will respond. There's a risk that we're not gearing up in the public sector to respond in the way that's needed. I mean, I talked about in Ontario, they pool the expertise. They have agencies, Infrastructure Ontario. They've done it 30 times. We haven't got that set up in here. Even in the UK, if I think about my work with Highways England, the resource that is brought to bear to deliver these projects is beyond what I see within government here. It can be just a pure capacity issue, but also an expertise issue as well. One final anecdote, you know, when the second Forth crossing opened this week, I think, or last week, you know, when they were set out building that project in earnest, there was an advert in the New Civil Engineer for a six-figure salaried person to go and run that. So that person that they got understood the risk, understood what it took to deliver that project. I don't see Welsh Government perhaps having that vision to say, what is this pipeline in the document that I was wavering around earlier, and how do we need to skill up in our own organisation to dovetail with the private sector to deliver together?
But Ben, unless I misunderstood you there, I think were you not looking as well, making the point, what role for the private sector beyond just pitching for things that somebody else has decided in their vision, actually feeding into the vision when it's being built?
Feeding into strategy. Yeah. And a strategic vision, and that should be the Welsh Government thinking about it.
To bring in the Arabs.
And be an early conversation in that, in the design of those projects and the design of the understanding.
So looking at the solution, bringing private sector in earlier.
Yeah, absolutely.
Does that?
Well, it's also one of the reasons why the National Development Framework process is so important, because that gives the opportunity. Now, they've done a very small, minor kind of consultation. If that were a wider engagement, and I think that's their ambition, is that it is a much wider engagement, then that is a huge opportunity for us to set down what we need. And I think what comes across with that, though, as well, is the need that, not to be territorial about it. Wales is a really small place, and we all have to benefit from this, so we all have to muck in. And this is no one's territory. You know, we have to kind of work on that together, and to build the institutional expertise that Dan is talking about. Take time out. Go listen to people like John Armit, you know, Olympic delivery. Listen to how they did it, you know, understand the importance of putting it outside the politics to people who know how to do this stuff, I think is very important.
Yes,
Arthur Emyr, Welsh Government. Is 5G a national imperative? And does the panel agree that the mining of data can be as valuable to the future of the Welsh economy as the mining of coal was to its past?
Okay, that's yours, Rodri, I think, isn't it? Data, sorry, scratching on.
Well,
yes or no, I think.
Thankfully, it's an easy one. It's a yes. The only question is, of course, it's going to happen, and the private sector will make it happen. But what it'll make happen is what it's made happen in the past, is that it'll roll it out first of all in London, and then it'll get to Manchester and Birmingham and Liverpool and Cardiff and Bristol. And you know, what's the time lag? Is it 10 years? Is it 15 years before it reaches? I speak as somebody there with some skin in the game here, in that as well as public money as a tool, public policy is a very effective lever. And one of the decisions that Ofcom is going to have to make in the next year or so is one of the ways in which 5G technology will be delivered will be by using a piece of the electromagnetic spectrum, you know, the airwaves, that is currently used by television. And that has the benefit of going a long way, going around buildings and trees and small mountains, not necessarily huge ones, but it gets further and it carries a lot of data with it. And there is some spectrum that is going to be sold off. Unfortunately, HM Treasury takes the whole of the receipt for what comes in. But one of the things we're going to have to decide on is what sort of coverage obligations can be attached to that, so that rather than just simply see it as a money-making exercise for the Treasury, we can look at it and say, well, if we want near ubiquitous coverage, are there models of coverage obligations that can be put in place that would give us a better result than a sort of 10 to 15 year time lag, as we've seen with many other technologies? And there are, you know, that they've done it differently in other places, in Scandinavia in particular, in parts of Germany, where people have been awarded, you know, the mobile operators have been awarded the licenses to use spectrum, but have been told, if you want to be able to provide a service in London, you've got to do Ceredigion first. Or, you know, outside in is a way of doing, yes. You know, there are different models. And I think we have to be willing to use the public policy lever very strongly if we're going to get the full benefit of 5G, because in terms of its availability, it's not going to be any better than 4G is at the moment. It can do a lot more, but it's going to be equally available or unavailable depending on.
So you'll have the same winners and the same challenges.
That is the danger, yep. Unless there is a sort of effective public policy intervention to make it happen in a slightly different way.
Conscious we start a little late. How are we doing for time there? Are we?
You're okay. We've got another 15 minutes.
Okay, we'll keep going.
Sorry. I've just got a quick point of information, actually. Right. Not a question. This gentleman here. I think you'll probably find further information in today's newspapers. Transport for London has quoted, I think, £200 million that they would expect, presumably per annum, from doing the sort of thing you said, sort of selling the data which they will collect from the mobile phones of people passing through all their railway stations, etc. Thank you.
Right. Calvin.
This on?
Yeah, okay. This is sort of a question for me, really, and for my the team at the Cardiff Business Forum I'm part of. Is there any evidence that, particularly, I mean, we talk about bigger and bigger pipes affected, whether they're physical pipes or wireless pipes. And, you know, 5G is very exciting when I watch Netflix at 4G when I'm stuck, you know, on the A470 or whatever, going slowly northwards on a bus. I wonder, and we are going to spend a lot of time thinking about this, but I just want to kind of raise it in public. Is there any evidence that a well-connected 4G broadband post-industrial or rural community is any
more prosperous, richer, more coherent than a not very well connected community. I don't know if that's, I mean, I don't know is the answer. I mean, we're going to try and find out, but it strikes me we have to be really clear in the discussion around providing the infrastructure that it is the exploitation, the productive exploitation of that infrastructure, and I mean socially productive as well as economically productive, that is absolutely vital. And this is just as true of Metro, M4, you know, if you build it, they will come, you know, kind of old Kevin Costner film, but when they get there, you have to have communities ready and enterprising and oriented towards using those opportunities. And I worry when I go to infrastructure events particularly that there is not sufficient thought given to the exploitation of these connectivities as they emerge, as they maybe should be.
Well, on a micro level, a personal view is in terms of productivity. In terms of the digital, if you want to work from home, if I want to work from home, where I live in a rural area, it's virtually impossible. Same for my husband. Sort of, you know, we get back, we spend hours on the phone to the various organisations, and then in the end, we then drive up a congested road to the office. That's a loss of time, energy, focus, productivity. So. It's anecdotal, but I'm sure Rodri would have the...
specifically talking about, I didn't think the question very well, and 19 middle class people, you're absolutely correct, yeah? People who are not this event, and
right.
They are so correct, and people who currently are either digitally excluded or don't have enough money to put on their phones to get page going in there. When, once they get...
Yes.
How do we ensure that people at the lower end of the socioeconomic scale are equally able to take advantage of the options of lovely people like us are, who are just waiting to be more productive and stay at home, you know, and not have to do the congested road stuff? That's what we're going to worry about.
Carol, you've been very focused on people and people benefits, so I'd just like you to come back on that. And
this is a... Let's take this to real life and outside the industry. My mother features large in some of my presentations. She's 79 years old and she still lives in Bryn Mawr next door to other members of the family. And while some of those other members of the family are watching Netflix or whatever it is they're doing, my mother is surfing the high street charity shops. And the most powerful infrastructure I have to find out if she's okay, because I can't get hold of her, is to ring each of those charity shops. And they will have just seen her. And she'll be on her way somewhere else, or she'll be on her way to the post office or something else. So there is a great big highfalutin digital conversation to have here, and there is, you know, a Mrs. Jones or a Mrs. Davis conversation. And there is a balance to be struck in an integration of those two things. And we, you're absolutely right, I would say, is that we need to do it. I'm slightly worried what happened if my mother had unfettered access to the internet. That's all I would say.
Rodri, your area.
To
address that point of the digitally excluded, I mean, I'm slightly worried about that because, you know, the good startup ideas and don't just come from middle class communities. There's plenty of energy and ideas out there. So is it about giving these excluded communities the tools to actually make it for themselves?
Well, it's more the skills, I think, than anything else, because in a sense, that issue, and it is a very important one, I wouldn't want to sort of make it sound as if it's a smaller one than it is. I think it's a huge problem. But of course, that is primarily a problem in areas that are very well connected. I think it's in the areas where there is poor connectivity, there is, a much clearer evidential base for the benefits that it brings, both societal and economic benefits. I think it might be a bit more difficult to justify at this point in time the investment to bring superfast broadband. I'm not picking on Blaenau Gwent, but to Blaenau Gwent, where the take-up is particularly low. So I think that is a real issue that needs to be tackled, and one, if I'm honest, that certainly as far as the UK government is concerned, has been marginalised to a certain extent. in that Ofcom as an organisation did have statutory responsibilities in that direction that were then taken away, and we're left with only having to do research in that area rather than being proactively involved in it. I'm glad to say the Welsh Government takes a more proactive view on that and actually does something.
Thank you. I wanted to bring in, I'm putting you on the spot a little bit, but the woman that asked the question this morning was around, I think it was you, around people, communities, excluded groups and so on. This is the area. Is there anything you'd like to add on the digital front? Don't feel, I've asked you and I said don't feel pressured, but it is an area of expertise for you, and I thought you'd perhaps be able to contribute.
Yes, I mean, you know, I think we find a lot of the people that we work with are very much in terms of, you know, entry-level positions. So, you know, the construction infrastructure projects are of particular relevance in terms of, you know, labourers and that type of thing. But, you know, there are opportunities throughout anyway. And we're absolutely interested in identifying those organisations that are really keen to make a difference. So, yeah, you know, from that sense, absolutely.
Digital would help.
God, completely. I mean, I suppose the training, you know, the digitalisation, training those people so they're ready for those sorts of opportunities. That's something else that we're looking at. We're looking at apprenticeships, we're looking at traineeships in Wales, you know, and that's key for a lot of the people that we're working with.
Thank you. Sorry to just...
There's also some really good kind of one-man band stuff, and in different disciplines like the arts disciplines where digital communication and technology has been used quite differently. I think Igloo are doing a project at the moment, part of their engagement strategy. I think it's called Fidget, because it's about engagement and the digital age, if you like, and a different way of creating community. That's coming from the arts sector. So it's often not just organisations or the disciplines we know, it's outside. And again, it's that great balance between everybody inside doing this and enabling the connections and finding the balance.
Yeah, and ultimately what we're looking to do is bring, I guess, people who are excluded socially, you know, to a state of social inclusion. That's really what we're looking at. We're aiming for that through training and employment, but there are lots of other opportunities, volunteering, placements, that type of thing, that still bring people into that, you know, better situation, improving their lives.
Was your question, Calvin? Does that make sense to some of those points that have been drawn out?
It does. I mean, I also take the point that without digital, you can't start to engage people with the opportunities offered by connectivity. But there's, and I've seen this tension, particularly in the metro. Yeah, I think it's true also of 4G, 5G, and other things.
It's so difficult to engage with people within communities who are switched off from government policy, from the next big thing, from, you know, who are, maybe don't have a job or have a job where they're required, you know, to work horrible hours. And the easy thing is to talk to the usual suspects. You know, the usual suspects are there in Ferndale or Blaenau Gwent or Machynlleth, you know, and they will turn up. We see this at the business school. You know, you get the kind of top 5 or 10% of SMEs will turn up. They tick your box for you and you go on and call your job done. And I mean, you know, I've had conversations with lots of private sector companies who suggest that the first thing you make is explain to people they can watch Netflix in 4G. You know, and then you talk about the potential for developing their own personal skills and opportunities after that. I think that there may be some truth in that. The problem is, as always, capital is easier than revenue. It's very much easier to put a pipe in the ground or a road up a valley than it is to engage with communities over the probably decades that you need to take people on this kind of digital or otherwise skills development journey. And that's something I think, you know, we need some sort of parallel commission, you know, to this infrastructure one to ensure that the exploitation of that infrastructure is appropriate within the framework of the Future Generations Act and all the other things we've got, to make sure that the benefits are widely spread.
Another commission. Dan, bring you in there. Just the idea that we need another body to look at outcomes to make sure that they are delivered.
Well, I'm not sure.
The replacement of the
I mean, the terms of reference, as far as I understand it, for the commission that we're talking about is to look at the long-term infrastructure needs of Wales. I mean, it's to me, it's as simple as that. If we're not bringing in all these different competing factors into that remit, then I don't see the point, frankly.
So a wide brief, and Calvin's point that it has to be relevant to people or else they're not going to engage.
I mean, if you look at the feedback on the consultation document that went out, all the responses were positive, pretty much, almost without exception. You know, 83% this, 86% that. There is a kind of groundswell that this is exactly what we need, and sooner the better.
There was a question.
Mike Edmonds, independent civil engineer. I'd just like to say that I think, going back to the title of this session, Creating Our Pipeline, if you look at the photograph that's behind you, if you just stood roughly where that was taken 35 years ago, the only thing that would have been there at the time would have been mud flats, the pierhead building, and probably the tumbleweed. So somebody, I think, earlier said, what can our future look like? Well, I think we can point to that sort of photograph and say we can deliver infrastructure for a positive future. One of my questions to you, Carol, this morning you mentioned about the private sector, and you mentioned 50 projects, 50 billion over 50 years.
I did. Not my vision, but...
But it's somebody's vision, and I would like to see that, one, articulated, and secondly, debated. Because, again, going to that photograph, the Wales Millennium Centre, at the time, if people remember, was a huge debate. Should we have a rugby stadium for the people or an elite opera house? The good thing is we've actually got both now. And I think unless we have this sort of vision and unless projects are put forward and we have that debate, I think we will just have such an inertia that nothing will happen. Put into context, 50 billion over 50 years is 50 M4 relief roads, but only over twice the time scale that we've been discussing the M4 relief road. So I think, you know, if we are going to deliver a better infrastructure for Wales, we need to get those projects up front, and it is private sector. Great, let that be a stimulus to the public sector to follow through.
Thank you for that. We're running out of time, but I'd just like you all, just very briefly, a final thought, because that does really bring us back, doesn't it, to that original question to Russell about what's the vision and is it clear? If we start with Carol.
The vision isn't clear at the moment, I don't think, and there was an important point just made about the importance of debate. But I'm just going to leave you with someone. I'm going to briefly quote someone who I think is still really important in this debate, and that's Nicholas Stern, Lord Stern, at his lecture at the LSE in 2016. And he said, if we get this right in terms of the investments, the way investments will be made and how we respond to the development banks, if we make all future infrastructure investments sustainable, we will boost growth in the short term, launch a dynamic wave of innovation and growth in the medium term, and embark on the only long-term growth path which can be sustained. That is our opportunity, I think. And I think not to seize that is a travesty.
Thank you. Roderick?
I'd like to echo Caroline's earlier point about positivity of the, of the vision, because I think if you look around the world, there are no compelling reasons, I don't think, why this can't be done in Wales. We have the resources, both financial, you know, whatever the, you know, the current circumstances are as regards public expenditure. We do have the resources, and we have the human resources. And I think it's a question, to a certain extent, of self-belief and confidence. And I think that combination will allow us to actually, you know, I think there are many aspects of life in Wales that have improved dramatically over the last 30 years. And I think we can do more and will do more as long as we are willing to take risks.
Yes. We're on the positive vibe now. Dan, a final thought.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to burst that balloon. So, yeah, I mean, I am optimistic, and probably as optimistic, Brexit aside, I've been my whole kind of nearly 30 years with ARUP, I think there is a reasonably clear vision set out in these new policy documents. It says we will. I think the politicians need to be held to account that we will. These projects are going to make a huge difference to Wales and hopefully see us over the Brexit hump.
Yes, and we'll just see how big a hump that is, won't we, in the coming weeks and months. Plenty there to get stuck into in your breakout sessions later on. Everything from taking risks, being prepared to fail, focus on people, talk it up, be positive. You've got a chance shortly to find out how we're going to finance that and debate how best to finance those visions and how to deliver them. But I'd like to thank you for your participation, for your questions and sparky thoughts, given us plenty to think about. And I'd like you to thank our panel in the traditional way for bringing that expertise and their own visions to this conference today. Thank you.